Howdy, and welcome to The Stoop. I'm Cutter Gonzalez, your host, and on today's episode, I'm in conversation with Graham Downey. Graham has done amazing work in his now home of Anchorage, Alaska, where he serves as Mayor Suzanne LaFrance's Special Assistant for Housing and Transportation. He's a smart guy with degrees from Yale Law School and Virginia Tech, and he is also just one of the kindest, most insightful people you will ever meet. He has this sort of like genuine optimism that is absolutely contagious. While Anchorage might seem a long way from home for most of us, Graham's story spans many states, and his fight for abundant housing in Anchorage can still teach us many, many things about our own work. And perhaps even more important than the insights into a successful policy campaign, which Graham certainly had, I hope you leave this episode inspired. Graham says he likes to believe that there aren't actually any NIMBYs. Not because there isn't opposition, but because we often have shared values at our core, and advocacy can be a process of drawing out and centering those values. It's a really beautiful vision, and for some of us, it could be a little hard to imagine. We all know that heat of the moment when so-called NIMBYs are shouting and you feel like they couldn't possibly have anything in common with you. I felt that way as recently as this very morning. But Graham's right. Deep down, and it is really deep for some folks, there is something good. And before we jump into all this, I need to provide a little disclaimer. I had some technical issues retrieving the audio from our conversation, and I tried to work as much post-production magic as an amateur like me is capable of, but you might hear a couple blips here and there. So I'm asking your forgiveness in advance. I'm still learning how to do this whole podcast hosting thing, and one of my biggest insights so far is to have backup plans for everything. Regardless, all the good stuff from our conversation is in the episode. So let's tune in. All right. Well, hey, Graham, welcome to The Stoop. So glad to have you on.
Thanks, Cutter. Thanks for having me.
Very excited to talk about your work in Anchorage, which is somewhere I think that has seen some big challenges and big wins on housing, but it's not getting the attention of a lot of us way down here in the lower 48. But before we dig into that, let's start with your story. How did you get into all this housing mess?
How did I get into this housing mess? So my probably first exposure, like abundant housing sort of policy, was in law school. I took a land use law class with Bob Ellickson, and Professor Ellickson's sort of an early like law and economics guy who had identified sort of the connection that zoning has between like racial exclusion and segregation and housing costs, and was like coming for law school a surprisingly sort of conservative, moderate place. And his class was so fascinating because with lots of real examples from New Haven. Like there was a building we were working on trying to create a worker-owned cooperative in the grocery store in the bottom of this building, but it wasn't going to work because the grocery store was heavily subsidized by the building because it had been the result of an agreement with neighbors to allow the building to go up as that there would be a grocery store in the bottom. So the building was like hemorrhaging money, and this grocery store were like hemorrhaging money because of this community benefits agreement. Also like just totally uneconomical. And the building also had inclusionary zoning, like it had a mandated affordability requirement. And Professor Ellickson noted like, hey, who lives in those affordable units? Med students, law students, like Yale undergrads, like people who like look like they're poor on paper, but are actually part of the same like class as the high-end clientele the rest of the building was looking for. So it was just a really interesting sort of very local exposure to a lot of the issues with zoning. Not to mention the neighborhood I was living in at the time, East Rock, is also where a lot of the sort of like new urbanism movement got its inspiration and founding, with like mixed use neighborhoods and sort of like bodegas and like amazing delis and coffee shops like inside of the neighborhood and walkability. And but also like, is that replicable?
College, in its various iterations, tends to reveal a lot about housing to us. I think that's been discussed on a couple of recent episodes of this very podcast. So, are you from Alaska originally, or how did you end up in Anchorage?
I grew up outside of DC in Falls Church, Virginia, which is in many ways like the most idyllic little town in America. We were like the hairiest, potterest town when I was growing up because
Harry's Potterist.
the most Amazon pre-orders of any like per capita of any town in America, because it was like small capita, lots of income. And then I moved to Jackson, Mississippi after college, went to Virginia Tech and went to Jackson, Mississippi to build school gardens. And saw the other side of like sort of the American coin, right? Like Falls Church was built on, in many ways, like economic exclusion through housing prices. Whereas Jackson, Mississippi was like the opposite, like white flight, total divestment. The neighborhood I lived in looked like a literal bomb had gone off, but it was actually just redlining, which was really eye-opening. I went to law school at Yale and then moved back to DC afterwards, where I met my partner, Annalise. And Annalise is from here, Anchorage. She's from Anchorage. So I followed her up because I visited and I was like, why do I not live here? It's the most incredible place on earth. It's like such a, like after this interview, I'm going to go cross country skiing. And it's just like the mountains are right there, the wilderness is right there, and the people are like so incredible. So really found my place, I feel.
Yeah, I've heard only good things, but I will say it's 86 degrees in Austin today, and you mentioned I think it's 20 degrees in Anchorage, and that's probably colder than I could muster. I love that though, and following a partner up there is beautiful. It looks gorgeous from pictures,
Well,
so
the secret about Anchorage is that the winter is the best. You know, like everyone comes in the summer and it's great, but it's kind of just like cold summer. I mean, the world, it's like incredible. Winter is just like, it's a winter wonderland here. It never melts, so it doesn't get that like gross, icy, freeze, like East Coast type of winter. And when it stays at about 20 degrees, it's, you just get used to it. And it's like not a big deal to go outside, even for, I love the heat. I love the desert. I love Austin, but it turns out I also love winter.
That's wild. I don't know if I share the love, but well, anyway, I love that, and that personal connection and the like manifold ways we come to the issue of housing are so intriguing. You know, when you got to Anchorage, how did the fact that there was a housing issue first reveal itself to you? Because I imagine that was pretty different from, the Mississippi and New Haven context.
Yeah, Anchorage has its own challenges, which is really interesting, right? Like, not quite the same history as either of those places. Anchorage is one of the most diverse cities in the country. We have, if you look at some of the high schools, it's just like truly no majority group. And there's so many different groups of people who've called Anchorage home, whether it's, Alaska Native folks or Pacific Islanders or, folks coming from Texas, a lot of Texans in Anchorage with the oil boom. So you're really struck by how diverse Anchorage was in contrast to Jackson and Falls Church, which tended to sort of be either white or black. So there's kind of a different set of residential integration in Anchorage, but you do still have, some segregation in terms of there are some wealthier, rich white neighborhoods and there are poor, more diverse neighborhoods, which is not really answering the question you asked.
That's
I
okay.
guess I was sort of struck by how crappy the housing was here. Yeah, I got off the airplane and I asked my partner when they banned the practice of architecture in Anchorage. And it, like, I was like joking and being overly critical and like a judgy East Coaster, but it's actually one of Anchorage's strengths, I think. Like in the 1970s, after the oil boom, right, went from being like just a population explosion in Anchorage in the 70s, and that meant a lot of crappy housing went up really fast. And you can see the legacy of that around town. Anchorage has like got a lot of strip malls. It's like looks better with a little snow on it, I have to admit. And that's maybe in some ways it's a strength, but it's been perceived as a weakness, right? So there's been the zoning code and a lot of the housing regulations have responded to that sort of boom and bust cycle that the city has experienced over the last 50 years.
Well, and funny enough, that oil boom in the 70s is why my mom was grew up there. My grandpa was an oil man. He left Texas to California eventually, and then up to Anchorage to work offshore on a platform. So the zoning, you mentioned that they were kind of in response to that. So are you saying that like the regulations came as a way of ensuring those big booms didn't happen, or can you parse that out for me?
So, when you look back at like the record of building housing in Anchorage, it's basically all of the housing in Anchorage got built like 1973 to 1983. Just like huge, like many thousands of units a year getting built. And now we're down in the range of like 200 units a year, and which is we're at
Wow.
sort of an all-time low. And so what happened sort of after 1983 is the boom kind of tapered off, right? And the end of we had some bust times, there were some foreclosure crises, as people like people talk about walking away from their home, just like dropping off the keys at the bank because it didn't make any sense. And the boom and then bust, and then the increasing sort of like issues with this quickly built housing, where maybe folks were cutting corners, materials were hard to get, left a legacy of like, oh, we need to prevent that kind of thing from happening again. We need to control growth. We need to make sure there are like pretty high
Wow.
standards for building things because we've now directly experienced what it's like to not have those kinds of standards. So from the 80s onwards, but particularly intensifying in like the early 2000s, you saw sort of the rise of like prescriptive zoning rules that are trying to regulate away the ugly buildings and the the like after effects of the boom time and the bust time.
That is so interesting, and I mean, markedly different from the development history and the history of zoning down here. How did you get active on making a change? Because you were part of a coalition, correct?
Well, I was working for like a do-gooder nonprofit called ACPIRG, and
Nice.
I was working on economic justice issues. And one of the things that was coming up pretty often when we were talking with folks about like medical debt or payday lending or any of the other issues we were working on was housing as a driver of the like people were taking out payday loans to make their deposit on their, rental unit. And it became increasingly obvious to us that like housing costs were a big driver of economic insecurity in Anchorage and in Alaska in general. And it's even more intense outside of Anchorage, with a lack of supply of housing. And then we also saw around it homelessness problem in Anchorage, just a lot of folks. And it's especially intense problem here, right, because of the winter.
Right.
And we thought at the time there were already enough people sort of working directly on that issue of houselessness. We wanted to maybe or use our chances this like think tanky sort of advocacy group to step back and think about the root causes of that problem and think about how can we prevent sort of economic insecurity, housing insecurity at that root level. And I had my experience sort of coming from this background of understanding that part of the, or maybe perhaps the main driver of the housing crisis was sort of self-inflicted in terms of zoning, restrictive zoning rules and exclusionary zoning rules.
Yeah, so those of us who weren't involved in the campaign, what did you get passed?
Oh yeah. Well, I guess parking reform. The planning department here had worked over a couple years to propose this really nuanced set of reductions to parking requirements. So they created a whole menu where if you created these like pedestrian amenities or you like supported transit ridership or you installed a bike rack, then you could get like a 10% reduction in the amount of parking required in your spot. It was this like very complicated menu. It like had targeted zones that were associated with the transit corridors and anyway, very like sort of Rube Goldberg type planning effort, which, in the planning department's defense is what the public had sort of and the political leadership had to that point been asking for, right? Like they went to community councils and they heard a few folks sort of grumbling at the edges, like, hey, why do we have these rules at all? But for the most part, the sort of direction they were continuing in the same direction that planning had been or that zoning had been going, but these really nuanced, detailed prescriptive solutions. And a group of us met in a friend's parking, unused parking space outside of their condo. And there was maybe like a dozen of us. And we'd all been, reading the books and reading the tweets and maybe tweeting at each other. There were some folks who had gathered, sort of knew each other on the internet, but hadn't actually ever met in person. And we convened, ACPIRG convened that group in the parking lot. to think about what would it take to get to no parking minimums at all? Like, why do we have these complicated rules? Who actually wants these? Where is the market failure? Isn't this maybe a good issue for sort of libertarian Alaska, where we can get some alignment in terms of like, we don't want parking spaces, we want housing, and also stop messing with our property rights. So we thought it seemed like a good issue to win on. There's sort of this opening with the planning department's effort and able to seize on it. And
that is astounding. Getting to unanimously eliminating parking minimums is remarkable from that. Like, you surely were up against the planning apparatus. And then also that there was already a vehicle in motion that you had to interrupt and say, actually, that's not what we need to do.
We had eight of us in that parking lot. The eight of us like texted our friends to come to the next meeting. We had like meetings in garages and homes, and we texted people to come out. And so meaningful, like actual authentic citizen engagement. It was kind of the first time the assembly had ever seen like a wave of citizens who were pushing for simplifying zoning rules. I think there, you know, there's been historically, we have a community council system here that gets regularly consulted when we do zoning changes. And the folks who've been engaged in those for years are really deeply steeped in the zoning code and tend to advocate for these types of complicated changes. So it was the sort of fresh wave of new people into the political space, I think, gave us a ton of momentum. The other piece is that no one opposed it. No one opposed it. Everyone, you know, sort of saw parking requirements as being an issue that impeded, whether you're coming from like sort of a bicycle advocacy, like pedestrian centric design, or you were frustrated with how many parking lots there were in town, or how much of the frontage of buildings was taken up by driveways. Like, there was aesthetic and walkability and economic. There were just like, it was sort of overdetermined in terms of support for it, which was great. And yeah. I think that the simplicity, the Rube Goldberg solution that we were sort of up against made our simple solution really appealing. Like the sort of contrast between this like really prescriptive, complex solution and our just get rid of them made the messaging really easy. I mean, most of the people were, it was like sort of a network of friends for the most part, which, as you know, obviously there's like political sorting everywhere. So most of the folks we were texting were people who tended to be sort of more on the liberal side of things. But it would pique the interest of folks who maybe we hadn't met before. I sat next to a dentist on the plane who was so mad about parking minimums because the city was like threatening to fine him like thousands of dollars a day for expanding his business. And he was so frustrated about it. And he stood up and testified from this like much more authentically sort of more libertarian point of view. I had just happened to sit next to him on the way to Yimby Town on the plane. And so the messaging, the clarity of the messaging, I think, brought folks out of the woodwork who had been frustrated, who'd actually sort of experienced the costs of the regulations, and were able to speak from that more authentically conservative viewpoint.
It does seem to be one of those issues where we get kind of strange bedfellows with the people who are in the room advocating for deregulation on land use, because deregulation would be the more right-leaning term we'd use versus kind of a lot of us who are more on the left of things. Oftentimes we agree that we should have thriving communities and people should be taken care of and, you know, those kind of things, but we very much disagree on how we get there. This is one of the cases where, like, we find a lot of common ground on how to get there, which is totally. It's so fun to see that. I don't want to take it for granted since I work in the housing space. What does parking have to do with housing?
Yeah, well, I think basically the gist of it is if you're mandating parking, then that's less housing getting built because that parking space is not a unit of housing, right? Parking takes up space, it adds costs, it just makes it harder to build more units of housing. If you're requiring sort of X units of parking per living space, then that's going to dramatically limit how much of the lot you can use to build housing. And there's not a problem that, you know, like if the market demands parking, which it does in Anchorage, people want parking at their houses, then the market will build the parking. Sure. We weren't actually seeing a market failure here. So the prescriptive and complex zoning regulation of and mandate of parking both increased costs, reduced developable land, and created veto points, as you said earlier, to allow folks to block a development they didn't like.
And all of those are such critical junctures in the development process, right? They add time, money, planning costs, construction costs, and everything else. So it's a matter of scarce space, like how much space do we have, and do we want to devote it toward a car or a home? And a matter of we have scarce dollars. Do we want to devote those to a home or to another parking lot? And this kind of cheapening of urban space by just being swamped with parking lots, I think is an understated factor in that too. Like, I don't know. I don't know if y'all have the big old strip malls like we have here,
Sure.
with like the big box stores that are like, you park at the back and you're like, all right, let me start my mile long trek to the front of Target, you know? But that is demoralizing in a way that I think radicalizes people.
Like Walmart didn't want as big a parking lot it is at it,
Yeah.
right? Even Walmart was like, our parking lot is too big. Stop requiring us to build these massive parking lots.
Yes, because that's a huge thing. Is we like to blame the store oftentimes, but it's a matter, it's an equation oftentimes for like how much square footage they have to how much parking they must build, and they often don't want it, which is shocking to a lot. It was shocking to me when I first learned it.
Right.
I was like, "What do you mean Walmart doesn't want to pave over, you know, 20 acres of land right out front?"
But that's parking spaces they have to plow. That's
Yeah.
pavement they need to maintain. Yeah.
So take me into the Anchorage Assembly. It's the Assembly, right? Is that the term?
That's right. That's our sort of city government.
So take me into the Anchorage Assembly for a sec, because I don't know like really anything about the political ideological split there.
Yeah, well, at the time of parking, what we had was the assembly has 12 members, and then we've got the mayor, who's independently elected. The mayor at the time was a pretty deeply sort of conservative person who'd risen on a lot of the concerns about COVID response. So pretty right-wing mayor, and was clashing very frequently with a much more progressive assembly. And there was a handful of members in the assembly who sort of leaned Republican, but there's sort of a super majority of left-leaning progressives, independents. And it's nonpartisan, so no one has like official labels, but I think it's fair to say. A lot of conflict between those two branches. Pretty emotionally intense time for Anchorage, lots of yelling and shouting about, particularly about COVID as like kind of a background for the parking. Which again is the reason we're really excited about parking is because everyone liked it, right? The mayor was really supportive of it, and so he was all on board. He was totally supportive, and the assembly was kind of coming at it for totally different reasons, right? They were worried about the cost of housing and rent being too high, but this parking was able to find some common ground between those two sides of the coin.
When y'all were starting to advocate for this, did you begin in any particular place, like with the mayor or with council, or was it like a grassroots kind of push first? I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, we're sort of funny. It was a little, I guess the group of eight of us who met in that parking lot were a little grass topsy. So we had some connections
Okay.
to assembly members. And actually, of the people who met in that parking lot, I now work for the mayor. There's one person who got elected to the assembly, and another person who works for the mayor, and another person who's considering running for the assembly next year. So
Wow.
it's sort of made of like the eight people there, and then, a ninth person who's also considering. So it was like people who were really just everyday people, but were sort of more close to that level of political influence. Anyway, all to say, we had a direct connection to Assemblymember Volland, who was a big, is a big strong towns guy, is like since gotten awards for being a YIMBY, is really bought in sort of to the theory of housing. Zoning is the problem with housing. And so Member Volland carried that S version, the substitute version of the bill that just radically simplified zoning. And we were able to work with him to get that drafted. And then once it was clear he was serious about it, then the planning department engaged with him and another sort of working group to actually go ahead and draft the ordinance, and sort of suss out some of the technical details. And once that was sorted, he pretty much laid it on the table, put it on the table. Sorry, that's not the right phrase. He introduced that substitute version, and there was no concern about it. No one testified against it. We turned out a bunch of people to testify for it, and everyone was like, cool, thumbs up. Let's do it.
That's kind of remarkable. And do you think that reflects, like, among the general population of Anchorage, is it just like they don't know about it? Or is it like genuinely people believe that this is like the right thing? And it's okay
Yeah.
to
Well, I know it's interesting. We did take
one way or the other.
we did not given the low profile of the issue and lack of opposition, like instead of sort of doing a blast, try to get everyone on board, we focused on activating folks who were potentially already aligned with us and excited about this change. So rather than sort of like a diffuse, trying to generate sort of diffuse, broad, unanimous consensus across the whole municipality, we tried to activate our most enthusiastic allies. And I think what we've seen since is that there are a handful of people who are now like, that was a mistake, because people are parking on my street and that's causing issues with snow plowing. But we didn't remove any parking spaces. The buildings that have gotten constructed since we legalized or removed the parking mandates have generally included significant amounts of parking. So like we the year after parking, the local housing trust was able to build almost 100 units of affordable housing for folks exiting homelessness because they were able to reuse a hotel and they didn't have to completely build a second parking lot to like go with that hotel. They could just rehabilitate the existing parking lot and even remove spaces to create green space for residents. So like there's still parking there though, right? But
right. Yeah. It just gives you greater flexibility and how you finance and then design these things.
So there are frustrations about, I would say, like the way that we manage the road, but we are able to separate those concerns from how we regulate parking on private property. And now we've got a right-of-way management study underway to figure out like, well, do we need to do opposite side street parking? And do we need to like ticket people who leave abandoned cars on the side of the road? We need, how do we manage this public space more appropriately to address snow removal?
That's an interesting contextual thing that we don't have to worry about at all here.
No, yeah, right.
Austin removed parking mandates totally earlier this year, which is a big win. I think we might be the biggest city still to have done it, but we don't have to worry about snow removal at all. So it's very interesting the eccentricities we bring to the policy table. I would have never in my life thought about snow removal. That's wild.
Yeah, but so I'll just say that I think that's the only pushback we've gotten. And otherwise people are like, oh, it wasn't that way before. Like, I think people are generally surprised to hear that the city is requiring people to build parking lots.
Yeah. I don't know your gauge on this, but it often feels like that's the case with a lot of the zoning stuff. It's like, until you've encountered it yourself, you didn't realize that those things were because somebody said you had to.
That's right. I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
It's remarkable. And so much of our work is really like raising the public consciousness that, hey, that thing you really hate over there, that's by design, you know, and it didn't have to be.
Right.
Certainly the case here in Austin where, I mean, we face a severe housing crunch, right? And we got a very YIMBY council elected and looks like we might pick up more. We definitely picked up at least one seat this go around and then probably another one. But it took creating a new imagination to like get that, you know, like people just didn't, I know I didn't realize before I worked in housing or got close to advocating for the issue, how much of it was so prescriptive.
And I think especially in Anchorage, there are huge cost drivers that are not funding, being very remote, right? Where effectively the cost of materials is very high. And then we're sort of entrapped in a vicious cycle that I think a lot of big cities are, which we have expensive housing. So labor is expensive. So construction labor is expensive. So housing's expensive. And then we also, you know, we've got to bury utilities 30 feet deep because of frost. We can't just, like I think in Austin, you guys can bury them like, you burn right under the ground, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you bury utilities 30 feet deep, you actually need setbacks to have trenches that are 10 feet wide so that they're 20 feet wide so you can get down safely to the 30 foot pipe. And that's, you know, gonna, with frost and winter, it's taken its toll on the infrastructure, whether it's roads or pipes, in a sort of more active way. So I think folks know that story of why housing is expensive in Alaska and don't necessarily expect housing to be abundant and affordable in Alaska. Telling the story about how zoning is also having a significant impact, even if it's not the only driver of costs, has been an important story for us to tell.
Yeah, it seems like that is the optional layer on top that you could remove to unlock more abundance.
That's right. Zoning is the thing we can actually control.
Right.
We're not going to make Alaska less geographically remote.
Right, yeah. Bring up, come on down, come on down. That fixed the frost too. That's a two for one. We just need to find a way to relocate Alaska. Problem solved.
I don't
Yeah,
know. I think we might actually be in the right
you're like,
place as the
no,
future comes.
you're like, I'm good over here.
I'm not trying to be close with the Texas right now, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I'm staying inside to avoid the heat. So no, that's really incredible. Curious what I think is next for y'all in terms of things. Like obviously parking was a huge win and there's been some other work done. What do you see as the big opportunities to improve things in Anchorage from
Yeah.
here?
Well, what's really exciting that happened since parking is that group of about eight people that met in a parking lot became a little bit of an institution. We started this thing called Anchorage Housing Club, in part with Welcoming Neighbors Network support. And that group has grown to, like, I think the list probably has over 300 people on it now. And again, it's like not anybody, it's like relatively highly engaged folks. So sometimes meetings have as many as 50 people turning out to them, which is pretty incredible for a city our size. So
That's
we
huge.
built this group, and that group is doing a lot of like educating each other. Like someone's getting really deep right now, I think, into transit supportive corridors. And to now, and to decision makers about like, hey, what's the impact of this? Why should we do this? So we've got this sort of group now of folks who are really excited about abundant housing and who are pushing for a more ambitious change, which has now given decision makers more of a mandate to take a hard look at zoning and see, how are we getting in our own way? What are those things we can control that we can do to reduce housing costs? And now I'm lucky enough to be in a new position. I've moved on from the advocacy world now to working for the new mayor, who got elected this July. And Mayor LaFrance has a really strong, housing is one of her top priorities, which is really exciting to see, and which is why she brought me on, which is really wonderful and flattering. And we're setting the really ambitious goal of trying to build 1,000 units of housing a year. We're between 200 and 400, depending on if you look at permits or if you actually look at things that got built.
That's a huge goal. It's amazing. I love hearing that. One of the things I loved about this election cycle, and there was a lot to hate, but one of the things I loved this election cycle at the national level was that housing was so much a part of it. Like you have a presidential candidate saying we need to build 3 million homes. I'm like, when in my lifetime have I heard a presidential candidate say, you know, we need to build X number of homes, and then let alone like create plans to do it that aren't just like marginal fixes that don't actually get to the root of supply. In Austin, our council has kind of become known as like the YIMBY Council since they've had this recent kind of influx of newer folks on the council who are very aggressively pro-housing and making big strides in that direction. Was that a similar thing with y'all? Was it like a matter of getting good people on the issue elected and then taking action? Or has there been a kind of latent appetite for a long time? What's that like?
No, I think we didn't, Housing Club didn't get involved in electoral politics at all. I think it was a mix of, there were some really strong folks who were bought into sort of the abundant housing philosophy already on the body. And then now three members of Housing Club are, one is recently elected and two are running in the next year. So I think there's like a sense, maybe a sense that like, the winning on the housing issues has empowered folks who really care about this and see it as a root cause of so many of the problems in Anchorage to like, hey, you know what? I want to be one of the decision makers. I want to be up there on the assembly making these decisions about housing policy.
Because the strategy here was, I mean, basically the crisis got so severe and policymakers were just not taking adequate steps to fix it as a regards supply. There's a lot of hand-wringing about housing prices, but not a lot of, okay, let's build more. And then very proactively, we got pro-housing folks on council here. And it sounds like for y'all, it was a little bit more like there was a kind of latent appetite for this without a lot of electoral.
Right. It's also, I think, maybe like Austin, you know, the housing crisis here was so clearly a problem. I mean, we had rent increasing 15% a year. We had housing prices increasing like up to, I mean, they were reached a high of something in the 400,000s, which probably sounds small for Texas, but
No, that's big though.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, compared to Austin, Austin, I think crossed the $600,000 mark for the median home sale price a little while
Yeah.
back. But that's, it's a very different context. I mean, we're a city of a
Well,
million
and then
people.
I heard recently we might now be as high as 600.
Jeez,
Right.
that's
I mean,
just
the
brutal.
average house that I heard a statistic, I heard recently that the in 2004, the average house that was sold was built in 1984. And in 2024, the average house that was sold was built in 1984. That housing stock, again, was built during a boom time, in a rush, in a hurry. And not all of it was built to last. So we're really, I think you look around town and my sort of glib remark about architects, I think people see that the housing is collapsing. And who is that impacting the most is the folks with the least ability to pay, right? The folks at the bottom of the economic spectrum who are, dealing with lack of heat or standing water in their units or collapsing roofs or whatever it is. Like, so there's this clear sort of progressive mandate, I think, to do something about housing, in addition to sort of the high visibility of the homelessness issue, which crosses partisan lines. Yeah, I think maybe what we were able to do as advocates was educate folks who were elected decision makers, and a lot of folks bought into that. I think where there's been post parking, there's been more contention, I would say, about zoning liberalization or deregulation. I think there are folks who in town are not convinced that zoning is the problem, and maybe who are attached or worried about sort of a repeat of the 70s and 80s boom with the like they're worried about shitty housing. And there's others of us who are like, no, we need more shitty housing. That's fine. Like, we just need more housing. We don't care if it's like a fourplex block, like it's just a square. Like, that's great. It can, grow and adapt and change later, but we just got to get it built now. And we've got to
A
let that
diversity of
organic growth,
options.
right? We need that diversity of options. We need to allow that organic growth. We can't afford to be micromanaging anymore. So there has been, I would say, since parking reform, and there has been more debate about is zoning the right tool to solve this problem, which has led to some contention. But I think there is an increasing view that we do need, even folks who are opposed to some of the zoning changes agree that we need more housing. So I think there is a broad consensus in Anchorage that this is a problem we need to solve.
That's important. That's important because I think when you can't agree on the facts that there's a shortage, it's a different kind of battle than all agreeing on the fact that there's a shortage and then how to build
Right.
the housing, right?
Totally.
That's a very different
Yeah.
fight.
And something we've been maybe successful in doing is defining the problem in a way that then produces more meaningful solutions. So, defining the problem, for example, we for after, well, this is probably not worth getting into, but after we passed parking reform, there was a second half of the ordinance. Do doors and windows face the street? How wide are your driveways? How much of the front of the building is dedicated to parking? And it was like a pretty, it was meant to go with the parking rules. So initially, that really complex venue of you get this reduction in parking spaces if you provide this pedestrian amenity. The pedestrian amenity menu, then in the site access ordinance, went from being sort of an optional carrot to a mandatory stick. And we accidentally, after we passed parking regulations, the same assembly accidentally, without anyone really noticing, including us at Housing Club, made every building in Anchorage illegal. Or pretty much. I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly, but like any grocery store that had parking out front, illegal. Any affordable housing development that didn't face their doors onto the busy street, but instead faced an interior courtyard, illegal.
Oh my
Yeah.
gosh. How did they unravel that? Did they, was it pretty swift?
No, well, so unfortunately, yeah, put a pause, especially Quick Inlet Housing Authority, who build almost all of the multifamily housing in Anchorage. Many years, they're literally the only builder of multifamily housing. And they're an affordable housing developer that gets tons of subsidies. And they said, hold on, you've just made everything illegal. There's no way we can't now plan for projects in 3 years because we can't buy land because we're worried these rules are going to apply. You just created this incredible uncertainty about the future of development. So the assembly was able to react after the housers sort of raised the alarm and put a pause on the most restrictive aspects of the rules. But now we're convening the mayor's office, us in the mayor's office and the assembly are convened a working group to sort of get back to what problem were these rules trying to solve? Like, generally, they were about walkability and pedestrian-friendly neighborhoods and fronting the street, like sort of good urbanist values were motivating this ordinance. And we're trying to define that problem in a way that then clarifies what the solution should actually be. And so we're able to say, yes, we agree, we should have flat sidewalks because they're less scary to walk on when it gets icy. We shouldn't have them all, you know, too many curb cuts creates interactions between drivers and pedestrians that make our neighborhoods worse.
Yeah.
And we actually do have these shared values. And we can say, hold on, the zoning code is actually not the appropriate tool to solve that problem. We have this other tool, how we design and build our roads, where we're actually spending public resources, where it's actually public property, where we can, let's change the rules for that to enable the kind of neighborhoods we want to see. So we're able to sort of shift, I think all to bring around to this point of, by more clearly defining the problem, we can then have a more productive conversation about, well, what is actually the solution that solves that problem? If we want walkable neighborhoods, do we want to mandate that every developer build a $500,000 sidewalk? Or when we build sidewalks, as the public, do we want to then regulate what they look like? So anyway.
Yeah. No, that's very smart. And that's a good way to think through that. We're coming up on the hour pretty quick.
Oh, geez.
So as we as we wrap here, I know we could talk forever. But as we wrap here, is there anything else you think we should know about your work that we could carry on into our own?
Maybe one thing I could share is, you know, something I think that Welcoming Neighbors Network preaches, and I think is completely true, is the goal is not to convince the diehard enemies. And I think one interpretation or one evolution of my thinking about that is, Maybe this is just true in Anchorage. Maybe it's not true in other places, but there actually are no diehard enemies. I think this sort of us versus them thinking is actually tends to produce the conflict that we're so anxious about. And that getting back to shared values and that sort of clear problem identification can really mitigate the amount of pushback and resistance that happens. And I think it's really exciting for Anchorage as a community to come together and be like, housing is a problem. We need cheaper housing. We need better housing. And the way we're going to get there is by getting out of our own way. Or at least we're going to do what we can control. We're going to change what we can control. Getting back to those sort of like big values and the why behind what we're doing, I think is really compelling. Because this is a really compelling movement. I think the housing movement, right? It's like truly nonpartisan, almost anti-partisan, that like everyone needs housing. And it helps everyone to allow more and more diverse housing to get built. So not assuming that there's necessarily going to be NIMBYs, probably not calling people NIMBYs is not going to be a particularly effective way to win, right? Like instead, I think being like, what do you care about in your neighborhoods? What are the values that you're trying to protect? What are you worried about for your kids or for the future? Or what sort of past history are you responding to? And actually listening to people and then coming up with shared solutions. Not this sort of pre-compromise, oh, well, you know, the NIMBYs are going to push back on this, so we have to self-moderate and we can only go after this thing. I think actually the lesson of Anchorage's parking reform is that the bolder and simpler the change you're going for, the more likely it is to win general support. But genuinely listening to other people to figure out what values are motivating them.
Totally agree. I think that's such a beautiful thing and a beautiful point to end on. Imagining a world where there are no enemies, and not because they're gone, but because they're also in the room with us. Such a fun little insight, I think. Well, Graham, thank you so much for the hour we spent together. It's so good to talk to you again. It's been a long time, and hopefully next time will not be as long.
Cutter, thank you so much for giving me a chance to think about the last couple of years. And also, I mean, thanks for all the support over that time too. I mean, it wouldn't have happened without, at least, I know you helped us create some one pagers and white papers. And so anyway, I'm very thankful for your support.
Oh, happy to help. It'll be good.
Wonderful. Thank you, Cutter. So great to see you.
Yeah.
Come visit Anchorage soon.
You
maybe
too.
Not in the winter.
I need to, I will let you know. Yeah.
Graham is such a light. When I was recording this, our hour together just flew by, and I'm sure you can understand why. He is an absolute professional and such a kind soul. I'm so grateful for Graham, for the good work he's doing at Anchorage, and for the opportunity to share this conversation with all of y'all. You can reach the Anchorage Housing Club by their email, anchoragehousingclub@gmail.com. If you have additional questions for Graham, I'd be happy to connect y'all. Just shoot me an email at cutter@welcomingneighbors.us. That's C-U-T-T-E-R @welcomingneighbors.us. You can also reach me on social media. My handle is @CutterWGonzalez across all platforms. And as always, you can also connect with the Welcoming Neighbors Network online at welcomingneighbors.us and on social media. We are at WNN Pro Housing on Instagram and Twitter, and at welcomingneighbors.us on Blue Sky. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll talk to y'all real soon.